Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Could the internet feel happy or depressed? It's a distinct possibility, according to the pioneering neuroscientist Christoph Koch. He says the internet's developing a staggering level of complexity, maybe even comparable to the wiring of the human brain. Koch is the rare neuroscientist who speculates openly about all kinds of big questions: computer consciousness, God, and just what it means that our brains have 100 billion neurons and trillions of synapses.
It's not the sheer numbers of it. It's the incredible complex ways in which these things are wired up. And so that makes it different from a galaxy. Our Milky Way, for example, also contains 100 billion suns. But the way these suns interact is very, very simple compared to the way that neurons can interact with each other.
This is an important point to make. You're saying that it doesn't matter so much what the neurons are made of. It's how they're organized. How are they wired together? That's what counts.
Correct. So unless you believe in some magic substance that attached to our brain is some magic stuff, you know, that exudes consciousness, which certainly no scientists believe, then the only answer is, it's, as you said, it's not the stuff the brain is made out of, but it's a relationship of that stuff to each other. So it's the fact that you have these neurons and they interact in very complicated ways. And in principle, if you could replicate that interaction, let's say in silicon on a computer, you would get the same phenomena, including consciousness.
So it's entirely possible that the internet could become conscious, or maybe it already is conscious.
In principle, that's possible. Correct. What matters for consciousness is the fact that you have these incredible complicated little machines, these little switching devices called nerve cells and synapses, and they're integrated, they're wired up in amazingly complicated ways. And if you could mimic that, for instance, if the internet taken as a whole, you know, the internet already now has a couple of billion nodes, you know, each node is a computer. Each of one of these computers contains a couple of billion transistors. So yes, it is in principle possible that the complexity of the internet is such that it feels like something to be conscious. And depending on the exact state of the transistors on the internet, it might feel sad one day and happy another day, or whatever the equivalent is in internet space.
You're serious about using these words, that the internet could feel sad or happy?
What I'm serious about is that the internet, in principle, could have conscious states. Now, the exact meaning of these conscious states, do they express happiness? Do they express pain, pleasure, angry? That really depends exactly on the relationship of the transistors and of the nodes and of the computers to each other. But there's no question that in principle it could feel something, yes.
Would we humans recognize whether there are certain parts of the internet that are conscious, or is that somehow beyond our understanding?
Well, if suddenly it develops some autonomous behavior that nobody programmed into it, right, where people say, whoa, what just happened here? I mean, it just sort of self-organized in some really weird way. It wasn't a bug. It wasn't some botnet that was paid for by some, you know, nefarious organization, but it did it by itself. Yes, and if this happens on a regular basis, then I think at some point many people would say, yeah, I guess it in some sense it's alive and it may have conscious sensation.
You like these big philosophical questions, don't you?
You know, I think a lot about my place in the universe. What are we doing here? How do we come about? Does it mean anything? You know, usually you ask these questions when you're 18 and 19, and then you get on with the serious business of living. And I guess I still, even at my age, I still ask these questions because I want to know before I die. I want to know, you know, how it all fits together.
It's worth pointing out that you grew up a Roman Catholic, I mean, an observant Catholic, and I know you have kind of lost your faith in a personal God, at least, but it would seem that that search for meaning, that yearning for the absolute is still with you.
That's correct. that's very much correct. You know, I try to be guided by the current state of our science, but I also see these facts that we find ourselves in this universe that is very conducive to life, and this somehow has to be explained. I don't know how to explain it, but I see this this arrow, this sort of progress towards ever larger complexity and to ever larger consciousness. And I don't know what it means. I can't understand it, but I see it, I observe it, and I'm happy. I'm content about it.
It sounds like you're not exactly an atheist. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not a conventional atheist that believes it's all just random. It's just a random formation. That's correct. Although, as you said, I don't believe in a personal God and any of the standard things that you're supposed to believe in as a Roman Catholic or as a Christian in general. But it's much closer, in fact, to Buddhist thought. I just grew up calling this thing God because that's my tradition, but it's not any God in any sense that we in the Western world would recognize it, I believe.
So do you look for meaning in the world of science?
I find meaning in the world of science. It's this incredible, beautiful, aesthetic thing. Isn't it a wonder that we can understand the universe using mathematics that's comprehensible to our minds? That's just absolutely amazing. I mean, there's no law in the universe that says that it should be like that. That fills me with a great contentment, I must say. Yes, and science does that to me.
From reading your book, my sense is that you take this one step further. You talk about experiencing the numinous, you know, the transcendent. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's something more personal. I often feel I don't know, I find it very difficult to talk about. I can't really describe it. I just feel I'm in a universe that's filled with meaning. I just see it everywhere, and I realize it's a psychological mindset. I fully realize other people don't have this. I have this. I think maybe I'm just more fortunate. It's difficult to explain, to put into words. You have this intense feeling of the beauty of the world. You don't know where it comes from, but you just have this very intense experience of it.
You know, it's so interesting hearing you talk about what I would call your spiritual side. I mean, given your credentials as a scientist and especially given your partnership with Francis Crick, one of the most famous scientists of the 20th century, who was also a famous atheist. Now, Francis Crick was what, 40 years older than you?
Yes, in fact, exactly. Hmm. Correct.
And is it fair to say that he was your mentor?
Yeah, he was my we had this, some sort of intellectual father-son relationship because the age difference, and we got along very well. It was a very intense experience.
What was that like, working with him? I mean, with someone who was so brilliant.
It was a sheer joy and pleasure. I mean, what happened so often that he would take the same facts that I would read and he would just come to a startling new conclusion, right? I looked at the same facts, I read the same paper, but then he made this jump, you know, because he connected these facts to some, let's say, to something he'd done early on in molecular biology. And sort of there he says, well, in molecular biology, we looked at these sort of facts from this point of view. So maybe we should look at these facts in the brain sciences from that point of view. And he was very, very good at that. Later on, he didn't sleep so well. So very often he would lie awake at night and think about things and come, you know, to breakfast table having great new ideas. And he wasn't afraid of continuously throwing out these ideas. Many of them were crazy. Many of them were, you know, interesting but didn't work. But occasionally there were these wonderful ideas. So he just generated, you know, per unit time so much more ideas than other people did.
Well, and as we've already said, the other piece of Francis Crick's story is that he was an ardent atheist. In fact, the story is that he actually left Churchill College in Cambridge because they went ahead and built a chapel over his objections. And you—
That's correct. I just visited it last week. I was just at Churchill College and I visited the chapel because of that story.
You have this background as a Catholic and, you know, you still have some sort of religious sensibility. Did you talk much about religion with Crick?
Yeah, we did. In fact, he was gentle with respect to my faith. I mean, he knew I had some religious sensibilities quite well because we talked about it. But I guess sort of his ardor fighting against religious sensibility had cooled by the time I'd met him.
Now, did you ever push back? Did you ever challenge some of his atheist assumptions?
No. We once had a very interesting discussion about death. It's one of the things I greatly admire about him, not only that he was, you know, a genius and a great source of scientific inspiration for me, but also his attitudes towards getting old and dying. I had this debate with him about death where, you know, he knew he had very short to live because he had colon cancer that couldn't really be held in check. And every time I came there, we early on in the morning when I arrived there, we talked a little bit about his current state of health. But then he would just say, okay, that now let's move on to more sort of interesting things. And then we would talk about science. And he kept that attitude until the bitter end. I mean, 2 days before he passed away, he called me up on the way to the hospital. He says to say, I'm sorry, Christoph, the paper will be delayed because I have to go into hospital. Then in the hospital, he worked on it 2 hours before he passed away. He dictated the last correction to his secretary. So, I mean, he knew he was going to die, but it didn't let him interfere with the serious business of trying to understand the universe, in particular trying to understand how consciousness arises from the brain. I mean, what an attitude to take.
Christoph Koch is the chief scientific officer of the Allen Institute for Brain Science, and he's the author of the book Consciousness, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist. If you'd like to find out more, you'll find a transcript of Steve's interview with Koch that ran in The Atlantic Online on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind.